Morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order. Time is 14 minutes after 9 a.m., April 16, 2025. With me today is Chairman Hoffman, Chairman Olson, Senator Keel, Senator Merrig, Senator Coffin, Senator Cronk, and myself, Stedman. We have a full committee to do the work today. We have one item on the agenda, update on the Alaska infrastructure progress. And that item, we have a presentation on the Alaska Infrastructure Progress Upgrade by Mr. Nils Andreessen. If he could come forward with his enthusiasm from the Alaska Municipal League to the table, and he knows the routine of introducing himself for the record, and he has a presentation. And we'll do the normal process here today. We'll do one slide if there's any questions, and we'll go to the next one and kind of walk through it. So we have him, or he has the ability to make whatever points he wants on each individual slide without being interrupted. Mr. Andreessen, the chair, or the floor is yours.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Nils Andreessen, and I'm the executive director of the Alaska Municipal League. And thanks for this opportunity to talk a little bit about where we've been, where we're at, and where we're going as it relates to what for the last few years has been talked about as an infrastructure decade. I will start by saying that when Congress passed the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act a few years ago, our members came together, local governments directed us to put a generational effort forward. If this is a generational opportunity for the billions of dollars that could come to Alaska, they expected from us to make the most of that opportunity, to maximize the benefit for Alaska. And we've taken that to heart as we have spent these last few years working on infrastructure investment across our communities. So just to remind us where we've been, this is a clip from Senator Murkowski's website. All the news articles that came out upon passage of IIJA, and I think Senator Murkowski was a key architect of a bill, of that bill, which corresponded to, I remember being in this room six-ish years ago talking about our infrastructure deficit in Alaska and providing to this body a presentation that pointed to about $30 billion in need when it came to water and wastewater and housing, roads, ports and harbors, and so on. So the timing of IIJA and what eventually became bipartisan infrastructure law, BIL, coincided with some clear insight from our members and from community stakeholders across the state that something needed to be done, and IIJA provided an opportunity for all of us to make a difference. And there was a lot of excitement in those days as we tried to figure out exactly what that would look like and what this generational opportunity would mean. When I think about what that opportunity has meant, we're looking back at this point, and the charts on the right are from 2023. I would update them, but those sites don't exist anymore. Invest.gov and Build.gov, we no longer have access to as federal agencies have undergone some transition. But I think this is still mostly true, right? So when we talked 5 years ago about an infrastructure deficit, we discussed the different buckets of infrastructure where there were needs. And IIJA provided funding to meet some of those needs. A large portion of that was transportation. You can see 50% or more of IIJA funds back in 2023 went to transportation, a quarter to broadband, a portion to water, to energy, environmental remediation, and resilience. I'll note that with the passage subsequently of the Inflation Reduction Act, those numbers will have adjusted to some extent. IRA provided more funding for energy, environmental remediation, and resilience than IIJA had. And so It's actually more investment in some of those items in more recent years. But you can see where IJA was directed, and you can see that for the most part, the state government has been the recipient of a large portion of those funds. It's worth pointing out that a large portion of IJA was formula funds. It was a plus-up of regularly occurring funds that were formula in nature, and so you can see, you can understand why state government benefited more than tribal governments or federal governments in Alaska or local governments. It's also worth noting that when it comes to state government receiving a large portion of those funds, often they were a pass-through entity. They were able to move those dollars out of state agencies down to local. And for the most part, that strong working relationship between the state government and local governments meant that there were partnership in delivering projects that fit the needs of communities. On the left-hand side, you can see more recent numbers. This is, I think, in the last 3 months, just a per capita or funding per 1,000 residents from a number of different programs and how they benefited Alaska. And the tribal broadband connectivity, ferry service for rural Alaska, the broadband reconnect program, surface transportation block grant, port infrastructure development program, all of those have had an outsized impact in Alaska compared to the rest of the nation. We've done very well for ourselves as a state. And I think a big reason we were able to do so well in these last few years has been the focus on disadvantaged communities. We actually had a competitive advantage in that realm when we were thinking about how to meet the needs of unserved or underserved communities, tribal communities, communities facing extreme poverty, or areas of persistent poverty. We fit a niche in some of the federal priorities as it relates to meeting those needs, and so some of these programs were structured very directly to address the needs like those experienced in Alaska. Next slide. Just to dig a little bit deeper into where we're at with transportation, this is from spending, let's see, USAspending.gov, I think, or this is from the Federal Highways posts an update regularly, so this is from February of this year, the amount of dollars that they've had enacted, grants that they've announced, obligations they've made, and outlays. And I think it's worth pointing out that for a large, that their overall, for what has been enacted in their budgets, they're only 68% obligated, only 35% has been distributed to grantees, either through formula or competitive grants. And I called out down below some of the grant programs that Alaska has really benefited from, maybe not most directly, but uniquely. These are programs where there's a lot of room for Alaska to still benefit, assuming these funds that have been enacted are distributed effectively. So improving our airport infrastructure, we're only 25% obligated for ferry service for rural communities, still some room there. Rail crossing elimination, there's still some needs that have been prioritized in the state. Port Infrastructure Development Program, this is an amazing program to help address some of the port and harbor infrastructure needs in our communities. Only 12.9% obligated. Safe Streets for All, 12%, and culvert removal, 3.9%. So you can see that we're not done in a lot of ways. For as much as there has been change at the federal level, there's still room in these enacted budgets for distribution of grant funds to Alaskans. Slide 5 highlights some of the big wins in Alaska. So USA Spending is still available, so you can go to that website that tracks the distribution of the grants. And I pulled out just awarded funds from between FY23 and FY25. You can see Alaska Energy Authority. I think you're familiar with their grid resilience efforts and this large award of $200,000. But a number of Alaska communities, entities, utilities, tribes have been beneficiaries of either IIJA or IRA funds. Again, IRA is the Inflation Reduction Act. And I tried to focus on those just about over $45 million, so you can see a pretty broad distribution in terms of type of entity, geographic distribution, and most of these, trying to think through, most of these are energy related. The ANTHC award of $74 million, I think that's coastal resilience funding, Golden Valley, that's energy. Some of these, the Alaska Energy Authority's on there twice at 62, 4, 5. I think it's actually TCC, Tanana Chiefs Conference, and ANTHC who partnered on that second 62, 4, 5. Those are both Solar for All awards that are being distributed through the EPA. That University of Alaska Fairbanks, that $58 million, you'll have seen recent news articles questioning whether that will actually be distributed. I think that was to promote some of our Arctic resilience efforts. So some of these might be questioned at this point, but you can see we've done a good job as a state for attracting funds. The chart on the right, and I'll apologize to the chairs and the committee for not having titled these slides or titled these charts appropriately, but again, from FY23 to FY25, these are total dollars distributed through grants to Alaska from the federal government. And you can see that just prior to a change in administration at the end of 2024, the largest amount of funding that went out. And you can see, too, in recent months how funding has dropped off. And that's, we'll talk a little bit about some of the changes that have occurred between administrations. But generally speaking, you know, we've seen between $3 and $6 billion come to Alaska each year, approximately, over this period. So I remember at our first infrastructure symposium, we had pointed to, you know, what could be goals for the state, and $3 billion a year, we thought back then was a good goal, and we've met that each year, at least, even just the competitive awards that have been able to come to Alaska. Slide 6 and 7 reflect on some of the challenges that local governments, state agencies, tribes have experienced along the way. These were all identified early on, and these have been areas where AML, state agencies, many of our partners in this effort have worked to address. So first and foremost, the need for matching funds, and I'll thank the legislature for including funding to the Denali Commission these last 2 years to help offset some of the matching cost needs of communities. And I think Denali Commission is just going through an award process right now to help supplement some of the needs of tribes and local governments to offset their costs on that front. Still one of the biggest barriers to accessing federal funds, and no good answers except for having more money. But we have, I think, learned a lot along the way, more interest in, you know, figuring out the right kind of capital stack for projects, leveraging loans, tax credits, and so on that could be helpful for projects. We've noticed along the way lack of interagency collaboration and getting not just federal agencies to talk to one another, but also state and federal to talk. A lot of discussions around project bundling and thinking through how do we make the most of limited funds where they're going into a community, or combining funds where they're for different types of projects or fund sources. Build America, Buy America has been an impediment for many communities. This, again, well-intentioned goal to reinvest in American manufacturing. And what it ends up doing is transferring Alaska dollars to other places in the U.S. where they have manufacturing or industrial capacity. And this is increased costs for a lot of local governments, tribes, for all the projects. So when we think about kind of what was budgeted for originally, maybe didn't take into account Build America, Buy America, and a lot of projects experienced a 20% or more increase in cost based on that provision in law. Similarly, in slide 7, additional challenges that we've had to work through these last 3 years, applicant eligibility, making sure that everybody who could advance a project was able to, and many federal programs are limited in who was eligible for programs, and that made it difficult because match was tied to that eligibility, and some who weren't eligible could have been in a position to provide match or deliver a project instead of an eligible entity that was that had less capacity. And that capacity is important. I would actually rank capacity constraints as the second highest barrier to more success these last few years, right after matching funds. And it's something that AML and partners like RuralCap and Alaska Federation of Natives, AFN, Foraker Group, University of Alaska, and a lot of other partners have come together to try to augment the capacity of eligible entities and basically be capacity where we needed to offer that or otherwise provide assistance. So that's something that we've all pitched in. And I think state agencies as well have been really helpful in helping communities navigate through some of those capacity constraints. And then I would just note, and you'll be familiar with some of the technological needs of communities and even things like bandwidth, broadband, and you know, whether it's submitting a grant application through grants.gov or logging in to submit ARPA reports or otherwise, really challenging for a lot of our communities. Slide 8 points to three areas where AML has tried to make a difference, and all three of these are really based on the investment that this body made into AML and AFN these last few years. The legislature appropriated funds to both entities to ensure that the needs of communities were met, that tribal and local governments had what they needed to access all of these available funds. So it was through those funds that we were able to host a website, akfederalfunding.org, where communities could access more information, identify grant opportunities. We hold the infrastructure symposium every year and sometimes twice a year to bring people together on these topics. And then more directly, we offer grant writing services to every tribe and local government in Alaska and nonprofit state agencies. So it was that state investment that really made the world of difference during these last 3 years. I think we wouldn't have been as nearly as successful in Alaska as we were without the legislature's support. And what that's looked like is, at least for AML, for applications to competitive grant opportunities that we had a direct role in, 214 total applications, $3.6 billion applied for, 70 of those applications successful, $1.3 billion brought to Alaska. And that's just for AML and staff and contracted support to deliver applications to meet needs of communities on this map. So fairly wide geographic distribution, tried to meet as many needs across the state as we could. We play only some role in all of this, and there are a ton of other resources out there, both private sector and nonprofit, who have helped communities apply for funds. And I think one of the differentiating factors for us has been that We didn't contract at high expense for a lot of the grant applications that we delivered. It was almost all in-house. So we would deliver grant applications for, you know, $2,500 in total cost. And a lot of grants can cost as much as $30,000 to develop. And ultimately, we wanted to make sure is that anybody who, any eligible entity who had a competitive project or not, if they wanted to apply for something, they could. Our job was to remove barriers and get as many communities who were at yes to an application, knowing that this is an iterative process. We didn't pre-select which grants would be more competitive than others or competitive one against the other, which is why we have more total applications than those were successful. But the idea was that this is an iterative process, and the more that communities have kind of a baseline grant, the more they can apply for and repurpose that in the future. So I think these last few years, we've increased overall the capacity of communities to step off into additional opportunities that might come up in the future. They've got a baseline now to work from that we'll be able to either support directly or indirectly. And then these are applications that they didn't have in the past and now can build from. So our approach throughout has been so augment capacity where it hasn't existed or where it's been limited. So augmenting capacity means that we're doing the grant writing, we're doing the planning and project development with applicants. And applicants can include both local and tribal governments, also state agencies. We have focused on increasing competitiveness of projects and communities overall. So we're building capacity over this period. And part of what I think has increased Alaska's competitiveness and success rate throughout has been the ability to bundle projects and data to bring communities together so that they're not competing with one another, but they're competing as a team against the rest of the nation. And I think that's part of a secret for success that we want to see continue in the years to come. Ultimately, our goal here is to improve the conditions of our communities, and bringing $1.3 billion in has meant that they're able to deliver projects that are crucial to the needs that they're trying to meet within their communities. And if our mission is to strengthen local governments, then a big part of that has been for us to connect them to tools and services either provided by AML or AFN, the university, or other partners. We provide that support and technical assistance to communities through kind of direct connection with those entities. We've developed cohorts, groups of communities that come together and share expertise and learn from one another along the way. We've conducted training and provide direct technical assistance to communities so that they have access to all kinds of resources to help them navigate through, again, this generational opportunity. And then very broadly, conducting outreach and information sharing to not just our members, but to tribes, to nonprofits, to a large list. I think you know, for those who have attended the infrastructure symposium, you know, we have a list of, you know, 1,500 or more of individuals in Alaska, companies and others who are committed to this these investments. So we stay connected and probably overshare, but in doing so, make sure that they've got the information they need. We were able to bring back the Alaska Rural Energy Conference this last October through support of the Denali Commission and other sponsors, and then host the Alaska Infrastructure Development Symposium at least every year. I think we're on our third or fourth year, and this next one is next week, and we'll have 300 people come together over the course of 3 days to recognize where we're at, what's changing, to move projects forward, and also really focus in and hone in on the needs for reporting and compliance. And now is more important than ever to get things right. We're also really focused on the sustainability of these projects. Bringing $1.3 billion in or having $3 billion come in each year to communities and state agencies is great, But if we don't have a plan for sustaining that infrastructure into the future, then it will be in the same position we were 5 or 6 years ago prior to this funding becoming available. So we really want to emphasize the workforce development, the housing needs, the ability to have maintenance and operations, planning, asset management, all of those kind of component pieces to project management in place as communities move forward. I'll start moving into some of the projects that have been awarded and in our process for that. So the kind of middle portion of these slides will dive into energy specifically and then to some of the other projects that we've seen awarded. But two of the platforms that we've had available and developed specifically to meet the needs of communities and the state. One is a transportation hub that's developed collaboratively with Alaska DOT. It's a space for any project proponent to submit a transportation project and have it evaluated both by AML on the federal side and then state DOT on the state side for needs that they might have. And then building off that that program, we developed the Alaska Energy Hub, and it's a place where anybody with an energy project can submit. And we'll evaluate both transportation and energy projects against available federal funding, and we'll work with the project sponsor to further develop their project, address budget issues, any pre-development costs that they have, identify ways for them to overcome some of the burdens or barriers to further development on that hand. So these are both tools that will outlive IJA or this federal infrastructure investment that can serve us into the future. It's worth pointing out that we've done a lot of this consistent not just with AML's mission and consistent with some of the investment that the legislature and the state has made into AML and others, but aligned with state priorities. So I want to spend a little bit of time on energy, and I was happy to serve in the governor's energy security task force a few years back. And in that task force, a number of goals, recommendations came out, both for short, mid, and long term. And we can kind of track some of the awards against the priorities that were established by that task force. So we've got some good, I think, examples. When it comes to rail belt transmission generation and storage, there was a working group that was dedicated to that with clear goals that came out of it. And the large award to AEA helps to meet the needs that were identified during that working group and that task force. Investments that were secured by GVEA up in Fairbanks and extending out to benefit Denali Borough and elsewhere, really helpful. AML was able to work with GVEA and Denali Borough on rethinking or thinking through energy assets in the Healy area. So a lot of progress, I think, that could be made when it comes to rail belt transmission. Slide 15 talks about another one of the working groups, coastal generation, distribution, and storage. We've been working on a project to help coastal communities identify clean energy savings. And I want to point to City of St. Paul just because they've done such a great job of, I think, applying for everything. And you can see the number of awards that they've had been able to secure since 2020. And in particular, they've been excited about the upgrade potential for their electric utility. Slide 16 continues that theme. Another one of the working groups of the Energy Security Task Force was rural generation. The Solar for All program, the $125 million secured by AEA, HFC, ANTHC, and TCC. A large portion of that is dedicated to improving conditions in rural communities. And one of the larger programs at the Department of Energy had to do with energy improvements in rural and remote areas, the ERA or ERA program. So these are examples of projects that have been funded that will advance some of the goals identified by the state. Another one of the working groups had to do with incentives and subsidies. Tanana Chiefs Conference has done a good job of identifying ways to utilize the tax credits that are available. We've been working directly with the Native Village of Yuzinki and the Native Village of Kuitluk on their tribal grid resilience consortiums, which are meant to deliver energy improvements in rural and tribal communities. Slide 18 talks about statutes and regulatory reform, which were identified by the Energy Security Task Force as areas to be invested in. AML participates in a project with AHFC that's working to develop a framework for responsive building code development. And the idea there is build it from the ground up, working with communities to see what's working, what doesn't work, where there are barriers, and where there's alignment or consensus for some of the things that they want to do. So we're engaged in that. I think we're in the first year of that. We also had a project funded to look at clean energy permitting and to work with local governments on areas where there might be barriers and to remove those. Slide 19 highlights some of the workforce development opportunities that we've been involved in. We've received funding from EPA to improve reporting capacity for rural Alaska local governments and tribes, funding from DOE for a rural municipal utility cybersecurity program, where we're providing cybersecurity improvements to 8 rural utilities. And then AEA and AHFC were able to secure programs for training residential energy contractors to improve energy efficiency in the state. So some examples of projects that have been awarded that align, again, with state priorities. State priorities that include energy storage and microgrid development. Almost all the funding that's been awarded through for these programs come from the Inflation Reduction Act, $78 million through, I think this was through the community change program that was announced at the end of last year. And you can see tens of millions of dollars flowing to different communities around the state. I would be remiss if I didn't address or highlight investments made into bulk fuel management and infrastructure. We had supported a grant application to address barge landing infrastructure in Western Alaska. And we've also been involved in a couple projects that have supported energy efficiency. It's an area where there wasn't really a lot of funding under IIJA or IRA as the prior administration was focused on reducing greenhouse gas emissions and environmental pollution. Some of the resources that local governments and rural communities depend on in the form of bulk fuel, diesel generators, and so on really didn't have a fund source. And I think throughout AML, AFN, other partners searching for, you know, where in a grant opportunity could we find some funding for these real needs that communities are facing. And I think there were some improvements there, but it's also an area where when the federal government didn't have funds for those things, it really probably placed more of a burden on the state to find funding for needs of those communities. So that was a lot of the energy awards that I think tie back to, and just a sample, right? These are things that AML was directly involved in, so I want to be able to speak to. It doesn't mean at all that there aren't a ton of other projects out there that the private sector, communities, tribes, everybody else had a role in securing for Alaska, and really it's been a team effort to get us to such great success. For AML, we have been involved in other project awards, so we're partnering with Alaska DOT and Denali Commission on rural boardwalk or board roads project, identifying where they're at, condition assessment, updating standards for those to improve conditions in communities, We host the Alaska Water Infrastructure Financial Navigation Center now to really drill into governance and financials of local governments and how they work with their water utilities to deliver benefits in communities. We're also working and have funding from the Alaska Community Foundation to support community capacity building in disaster-impacted communities, specifically in Western Alaska, in Murbach-impacted communities. That capacity building effort extends into other programs. We support and are contracted by DEC to develop the state's sustainable energy plan. It's through a CPRG grant from EPA, but helps with some of the air quality monitoring and data identification and identifying projects out of that. We secured funding from Senator Murkowski through a congressionally designated spending to purchase $4 million worth of heavy equipment to get out to 8 communities across Alaska. And this is an area where there's just often not a lot of funding available. And so this bundled approach is something that we're going to continue at least at the congressional delegation level, they've been supportive of. Community Compass has us working with HUD and housing authorities to build capacity, not just for grant writing, but for investment into housing. And then it's been through a collaborative effort between the Arctic Energy Office, DOE, and Denali Commission that AML hosts the Arctic Energy Ambassadors, which means we've got a person in every region in the state who's on point to address regional energy planning, project identification, and ultimately grant writing and finding funding for those projects. Finally, slide 24, additional types of capacity building that we're doing. We're working with coastal communities on resilience planning, working with Alaska DOT on developing community connectivity action plans for transit and transportation, building up enhancing some of the state planning efforts. And then we work with the Pacific Northwest Economic Region on their Regional Infrastructure Accelerator, developing a TIFIA plan for Alaska. That's TIFIA is a low-cost loan program offered by the Build America Bureau. So all of these efforts, projects that have been awarded during this period mean that we're in a good position, I think, to continue to support communities, deliver benefits that really, I think, you and legislature, the state, was hopeful for when BIL was adopted. I know that I've heard within this building and, in our discussions with communities, a need to address the rural communities, small communities, where there's not capacity, really focus in there to make sure that they have just as much an opportunity as everybody else. And we haven't discriminated at all in the outreach or the benefits that we've tried to achieve, whether it's our members or others. Ultimately, our members said, make the most of this opportunity, maximize benefits to Alaska. And that's what we've done. And we couldn't have done any of that without the support that the legislature and state has provided over these last few years. I want to shift gears to kind of where we're at or where we're headed from here. And so these next few slides will close out my presentation as we're thinking about where we're headed. We have a new federal administration in place, President Trump, who come with very different priorities than the previous administration. Here's just a short list, screen grabs of news articles and other items that have identified where cuts to programs, canceled grants, and so on have impacted all the success that we've experienced these last few years. And it's worth noting that for as much as we can point to success in awarded funds, and even in just the slides that I presented related to energy, a lot of those programs are called into question. A lot of those programs could be still canceled. A lot of the benefits that we've worked hard on over the last few years may not materialize. And for all the hard work that went in for communities that have spent thousands of dollars on preparing applications, doing project development, securing match, and so on, much of that could be for naught for some of these programs. And I was disappointed to see, you know, most recently that Skagway may not benefit from, I think, what, the first successful competitive BRIC award from FEMA in the state. To mitigate the rock slide danger in that community. And there's going to be holes that appear in communities that we're counting on project funding to come from this federal infrastructure investment. It's also worth noting that it's not just canceled projects, it's agency reductions, and where there's not agency staff, that has a direct impact on communities able to move grant agreements forward. Most recently, the entire grants division based in Alaska at Federal Highways is no longer there. They accepted their early retirement, and now all the grantees, either pending awards or waiting to move their awards forward, will be contacting a general inbox elsewhere in the nation. So there's a lot of turmoil, a lot of lack of clarity, not a lot of good communication from federal to state to local, and we're all in a space where we're trying to sort through what exactly that will mean for any of these projects and for communities that have worked really hard to see conditions improve. So not good answers here, and all of this is just knowing, I mean, these things are kind of where we're at. They're real things occurring in our communities. Slide 26, I want to dive just briefly into some of the executive orders. And I think there's 131, so I'm not going to go through all of them. And I want to keep this specific to infrastructure. There's a lot more to changes going on at the federal level than you asked me to deliver on. Or that I'm prepared to, but a lot of these have specific connotations to the effort that has been made these last few years when it comes to infrastructure. And so I want to speak to that and kind of set us up for thinking about some next steps. So first, I talked earlier about the competitive advantage that Alaska had when it came to accessing and being successful at federal awards. A lot of that had to do with equity and environmental justice and rural and disadvantaged communities who could point to challenges that they were experiencing in a federal government that had that as a priority. So that's no longer the case, what agencies are doing right now is kind of going through a vetting process for all currently awarded projects. It goes through a staff level review, then it goes to a manager level review, then it goes to a regional director review. At any of those levels, those projects could be canceled, not just because they have to do with equity or environmental justice, but there, I think, 14222, a cost efficiency initiative, also takes a finer point to that it's not about those words, but it's about cost savings that those agencies need to be looking for. So at any place along the way, they can be found to not meet the requirements for moving forward. And if they are above a certain amount, I think it's even $100,000, it has to go to a review by DOGE and consistent with 14158, that establishing and implementing DOGE. So there's additional layers now of bureaucracy where each of these projects will be evaluated, and grants and contracts are being canceled, can be canceled. AML has experienced at least one termination based on the words that are identified in 14151. All just trying to do good stuff, enhance resilience in Alaska, meet the needs of underserved communities, but that's the experience kind of being felt on the ground in our communities, and we receive emails every day from local governments, from tribes who are working through and navigating a very uncertain environment. I think if you, I highlighted two different types of executive orders on this list. There are executive orders that impact how we engage with the federal government as it relates to all these infrastructure projects. That would include 14210, workforce optimization, 14222, cost efficiency initiative. Each of those looking for a reduction in federal agency workforce. The workforce optimization, I think, points to you can't replace a staff at the federal level until you've lost four staff. So I mentioned earlier the Federal Highways Grants Division in Alaska. Four people each took the early retirement. There's zero people in that office now. If it comes back, it can only come back as one person under that executive order for managing the billions of dollars in awards that are coming into Alaska. 14238 reduction of federal. All of these things have an impact, and we're trying to sort through what that impact will be. If you read through any of these executive orders, so there's a policy section and then there's basically an implementation section. In the implementation section, we'll ask from each agency in 30 days, we require this from you. In 90 days, we require this. In 120 days, we require this. And, it can be a report, it can be an evaluation, it can be a change in how something is being delivered. All of that's coming at the same time that the workforce is being diminished. So we just went through, 3 years of a federal workforce ramping up to deliver billions of dollars in Alaska to meet the needs of infrastructure that the communities have. A change now where all that workforce is going away and they're being asked not just to evaluate the investments that have been made, but respond to new executive orders that transition them into new priorities, and a lot of the priorities that are consistent with Alaska's interests. And I want to acknowledge that AML members have a resolution in place emphasizing the need for and support for resource development. And I can look at this list and think about the benefits to Alaska from timber production, mineral production, maritime dominance, extraordinary resource potential, a lot of things where Alaska can benefit from, and we have to think about then what's the capacity at the federal level to implement this, what's our capacity to respond, and so on. I think with that in mind, slide 27, and I think this is maybe a call to action or... that would be going too far. I think it's worth consideration, at the state level to think through for those two types of executive orders, for those two types of shifts in federal policy, how do we navigate through challenges that might be being experienced at the local level and, state agencies. It's really common in a project or even under kind of a risk mitigation framework, you go through and develop a risk register, right? And for a project development, that means, we're concerned about supply chain and workforce and inflation, and in the risk register it says, all right, here's the potential, here's the plausibility of that, the scale of the impact, and you develop a mitigation process. Here's what we could do if this happens. And you could expect that, you could apply staff to or ask state agencies to think about what are the impacts from each of these and how should we be prepared to respond. And on the other hand, there is for where there is economic development opportunity and where you see or the state sees potential, how do we get ready for that? And I remember hosting an Alaska Dialogue decades ago that talked about getting ready for the next boom. It had to do with a natural gas pipeline, and it thought through what will the housing, what will that need to look like? What will workforce development need to look like? Which communities will be impacted? And all of this supports kind of and I think encourages you to think about and others. What's our strategy for moving through opportunity, challenge, and how can communities be prepared? This is work that AML is doing right now as we're shifting into a new space. It's consistent with some of the EOs that are out there, 14239, that moves away from an all-hazards approach to preparedness and mitigation to one that is risk-informed. We can be really specific in how we think about a strategy for meeting the needs of communities. So this is something that we should all, I think, be thinking about. And it's just lessons learned from these last 3 years and through all this infrastructure investment. I remember when IIJA was passed and the state and the legislature and the governor's office, state agencies, you know, stood up an office of infrastructure, said, how are we going to make the most of this, and wanted a plan. I think we always need a plan or a strategy for responding to federal landscape, but also state circumstances. And I certainly understand where the state's at and being able to either leverage these opportunities or navigate some of the risk. And by risk, it's judgment-free, I would say. I mean, I think one of the things to be mindful of when it comes to risk is where there's not a federal agency or federal support for cybersecurity anymore, for risk sharing. What's the state's plan for ensuring that risk is mitigated? What's the state's plan for working with local government to make sure that, you know, elections are conducted correctly without, you know, what the funding that was available for those in the past? One of the EOs talks about shifting more responsibility for risk mitigation to state and local governments. Does the state have the capacity and the resources available to do that? If there's no FEMA, what's the state arm that's resourced to be ready for emergency management and hazard mitigation? There's an EO that could restrict the state from taking action related to carbon credits or carbon mitigation type activities. So what will that look like as we evaluate some of the promises that we've heard over these last few years? So all of these things just will take somebody, I think, paying attention at the state level and I think within the legislature to where are we at and how will we navigate these next few years. I will say AML's prepared to do a lot of that work in the same way that we have been and were prepared to do a lot of the work to get us through, you know, an infrastructure period and respond effectively to the bipartisan infrastructure law. Each of these steps in planning and community development were identified during the first infrastructure symposium. These were areas where 1,000 people said, here's how to plan for this incoming infrastructure investment. And we need capacity from community planning and prioritization all the way through asset management and sustainability to meet the needs of our communities. And we've spent the last 3 years thinking about what is AML's role for each of these elements. We've certainly spent most of our time on grant writing, it feels like. And I did present or provide late a report that we had produced to the legislature on some of our grant writing lessons learned and outcomes. But we're turning now to what's needed on the community planning level. We've got grants in place that will continue to support the community planning. We have work to do on grant development response. How do we manage those grants? If we have a federal directive to evaluate each of these grants and contracts for reasons to terminate them, how do we make sure that tribes and local governments and every other awardee is compliant, is reporting on time, and so on? So we've got work that is emphasizing the reporting and compliance. We're thinking about procurement, workforce, project management. We're doing more of that. Maintenance and operations, asset management. We have an e-learning module for asset management, and we're moving into procuring an asset management system where each local government will have access to software that helps them do some of that asset management. And so those shared services are a big part of where we're headed. It was always kind of the plan when we think about sustainability of, if BIL was 5 years and maybe the funds trickle out over 10 years, at some point there will be a need to shift. For AML, the best way that we can support our members is to continue providing services that are available to all. And not just to our members, but to any others who need them, and kind of keep thinking about that's making the most of the opportunity and maximizing benefits to Alaska. So when it comes to planning and community development, I do want to recognize in the room Aaron Reinders is our Senior Director for Planning and Community. Community development. And we have an entire division now that's dedicated to supporting communities through through these efforts. And that wouldn't have been possible, you know, without some of the investments the state has made from learning these last few years. This is a different AML than you knew 5 years ago. We've grown to meet the needs of communities. And I think we're in a good position to continue doing so as these years unfold. My last slide is just to really drill into and wrap up the things that we're prepared to do as we continue to leverage the investment that you have made, that the state has made, and so many of our other partners. AML will continue to expand or enhance the shared services that it provides. So that includes community-oriented municipal planning. I think the full name includes, like, as a shared service. So it's Compass, if you ever hear me talking about Compass. But we have, we're doing a comprehensive plan right now for one community. We've been asked to do a comprehensive economic development strategy for another community. We just completed a hazard mitigation plan for a tribe. This is something that AML will do more often because we want to reduce barriers to any of those community entities having plans and being able to afford to get to them. I mean, I think we have a vision of a hazard mitigation plan and a comp plan and a capital improvement plan in every community. And if you can't get there on your own, AML is prepared to support you through that. I mentioned reporting and compliance. We have a staff member, we have a director of reporting and compliance who's not there just for us, but is a shared service for all communities to access. That means all the things related to procurement, all the policies that you have to follow in your special terms and conditions of a federal grant award. We're increasingly doing project management. I mentioned asset management, and Aaron would be mad if I didn't. But not only are we doing the training and technical assistance for asset management, but I'm really excited about having a software solution that folks can plug into. And that software solution separately will be starting to offer a GIS and data management for planning. So every community can have access to statewide data, their own data. They can conduct planning processes that each of these, what is individually a planning document, can live on and actually be editable into the future through a system where everybody has access. So those shared services are all in the works or in place. We'll kind of work toward this strategic plan for risk mitigation and opportunity development to make sure communities are ready so they know, here's the impact, here's what you can do, here's the opportunity, here's what you can do. And it's really as straightforward as thinking through next steps and options that communities might have to respond to either. I bring up fiscal first aid because, I mean, I think this is especially important right now for a federal government that's looking at cutting funds to a lot of programs, for a state government who's, like I heard, haircut, is working on trimming its own budget. Local governments who see increasing needs in their communities and may have to take on more as a result of some of these other shifts. We have a tax conference that we're hosting later this year, so we'll look at what are the revenue options for local governments, not always for more, but how to do it well, how to do it better. And make sure we've got sophisticated approaches to implementing taxes and revenue collection in Alaska. Again, thinking about a capital stack and the opportunity for bonds and loans, other types of investment opportunities, we'll be providing more and more of that. More resources, we've been asked more and more often to help with budgeting, modeling, projections related to financials and project feasibility, ultimately to get and help communities through identifying and meeting their short and long-term needs including for deferred maintenance, so that when it comes to deferred maintenance and operations or you know, needs in future years, that there are accounts set aside to meet those purposes. Ultimately, all of these things, in my mind, lead to communities that are more self-reliant, that will always be interdependent, often with the state and federal government, but can also be prepared to do more and more on their own. So all of this is consistent with our vision, mission, and values, and I will wrap up there. Chair, thank you.
Sounds good. I think the committee gets an award for going through 30 slides without a question. That's good. Do we have any questions? Or the State Office of Infrastructure, is it still in existence? Do you have much interaction with it?
Yeah. Chair, yes, there's still a Governor's Office of Infrastructure. I think it's Colette Schroeder, who's the staff there. AML hosts a kind of an Alaska Infrastructure Coordinating Committee that meets every 2 weeks, and so they've been actively, they participate in that. They send out, I think, a weekly federal funding update that includes either grant opportunities or trainings or events or other types of activities. Maybe I'll leave it at that.
Okay. Yes, go ahead, Senator Kaufman.
Thank you, through the chair. You described a lot of activities. At one point on slide 28, I believe, you mentioned opening a division for community planning and prioritization. Just wondering if you could give us a kind of just a thumbnail sketch of kind of all these things you're involved in. What's your staffing look like? So kind of what is the annual operations, the spend, the revenue, and number of employees that are doing all these things?
Yeah, Senator Kaufman, through the chair. So when I started at AML 7 years ago, we were three people. I was one of three. Today, I think we're 28. We could hire 3 to 5 people more based on currently funded or obligated projects or grant awards. I'm a little bit uncertain right now, so I don't want to take too many next steps there. But we've grown. We've grown in response to needs of communities. I think this division of planning and community development is kind of at the heart of what AML is commissioned to do. We're a nonprofit that provides governmental services, so it's a different kind of nonprofit than you might be used to. And planning and community development is kind of one of the core elements of what local governments do. So if a vision is, you know, removing barriers and ensuring that every local government, every community has the plans and prioritization and development of projects that they need to enhance community and meet community needs, we want to scale up to meet those needs. So it's the way that for us to do that is through kind of this cohort approach. So do many plans to get all at once. So we're doing 20 safety action plans all at once instead of just one, and for as much as what one would cost. So the idea is the more we can do all at once, the less it will cost for each. I think the other kind of component of that is we also have access to a contractor pool. So where we can't do it and don't have expertise, where we can contract for it. But instead of every local government having to go through their own procurement process, they can be assured that ours meets their standards. So centralizing, streamlining some of that, we're just trying to find efficiencies that saves them money, kind of keeps tax dollars in those communities. And it feels like we're growing a lot, but it's really not at the expense of anything. It's really trying to save communities otherwise. So augment capacity where we can.
Okay, we have other questions before we finish up today? You have any closing comments?
Senator, I think, thank you for no questions throughout it. I get a gold star when I say no to something. My staff give me one, and I've only gotten, I think, not five yet in the last 3 years. So I think what you experienced this morning is really the result of us saying yes to everything because there's so much need. And I appreciate the engagement that we've had with you, state agencies. It's really, I think, been a period of time that has been defined by collaboration, by working together, and AML and others who are really driven to how do we do this all together, how do we work together and meet needs that we haven't otherwise been able to. And federal investment has helped, but I don't think it ends there. I think we've got a lot of opportunity ahead.
Okay. Thank you for putting the presentation together and taking the time to come in and keep us up to speed in a changing environment, and it's certainly changing. So that concludes the meeting today. There will be no, I don't want the committee to revolt, but there's no meeting this afternoon.
Oh, man.
Our next meeting will be Wednesday. That's Wednesday, the 23rd of April at 9 a.m. And it is now 10:18.
19.
Yeah, we are adjourned.